Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Cyber Security Recruiter podcast. Today, I'm joined by Justin. How are you doing?
I'm doing great today, Thomas. It's good to connect. Excited to chat with you. Yeah,
no, likewise, mate. It's been nice having a little chit-chat before we came on and the post-COVID era of podcast recording. We've had maintenance men arriving. We've been chatting away. It's been all good, though, hasn't it?
Real life intercedes in our work all the time, right?
Yeah, no, good. Justin, I'm looking forward to today's show. I'm looking forward to diving into aspects of security. I know you're an experienced businessman as well, so it'd be nice to dive into various things in relation to that. I think there's a lot of value you can add to the listeners. But I'll just start off by, for those of people that don't know you, Justin, I'm just going to do you a bit of an introduction. So Justin Beals started back in the mid-90s as a network security engineer. You were also around that sort of time a web designer as well. You then progressed on to director level, director of multimedia for NextLeft. Then you founded and led a company called Roundbox Global. Over 130 staff were involved with that company, so a fairly sizable company. You then progressed on to practice head of custom solutions. You were also then moved on to senior executive director of Mac Labs in New York City. You then operated at VP level for Hot Chalk Inc. You were the CTO for Cora, and then you founded another company called Next Step. You were the CTO and co-founder of that. You've also been an advisory board member for Edify Software Consulting. You were also a board member for Valid 8 Financial. You were a entrepreneur in residence for Madura Venture Labs. You've also been a board member for ADAR Developers Academy, and you are currently the CEO and co-founder of StrikeGraph. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. But it's been an absolutely amazing career. I'm very proud of it, of course.
Yeah. I can imagine. But I'll start where I always start, which is, who are you? What do you get up to on a day-to-day basis? What's life like in the life of Justin right now?
Yeah. So let's see. I certainly am very proud of my career, and I definitely enjoy my work. It's hard work. It's complicated. It's challenging. It doesn't brutalize my body physically, so I can keep up with it, although the emotional toll can have its impact. Yeah. I've been around a lot of different companies in a lot of different roles, some very big. Mac Labs was a part of the bigger Macmillan Publishing, Holtzbrinck Group. I've worked in Silicon Valley. I've bootstrapped businesses before, so I've done a fair bit. From a day-to-day perspective, I live in a very small town in Washington, not too far from the Canadian border. I'm surrounded by farmland in a little village. We have less than 1,000 people that live in the village. So my morning usually starts with a walk with the dog down to the water. Today, the seals were playing in the water. They were splashing all around. It was so cool. Big adventurer. I think that is also a part of my career. I taught rock climbing when I was a teenager. I was an avid whitewater kayaker for many years. I do a lot of sailing and sailboat racing these days here in the Pacific Northwest. I've been getting into this thing called a surf ski lately, which is like a gigantic kayak that you can downwind. It's really crazy. And since I was 7, I've been a skateboarder. Still get out and ride the half pipe these days. Yeah.
Cool. Do you know what? There must be something. The amount of cybersecurity folks or hackers that I've spoke to that go rock climbing or do something like really crazy on a weekend, there must be like something that has to, like, you maybe you have to go from being on the keyboard to just, I don't know, just complete. There must be something that encourages that, because it's more common than we think, isn't it?
Yeah. I do think you want to switch gears from staring at the computer screen a fair bit. And also, especially tech is a startup world these days. We're not media, which has been around for a longer time, or print or carpentry or other types of roles. And many people that are in startup spaces or that are founders, they're interested in testing limits. That's what we do in a lot of ways when we build companies. And limit testing is inherent to skateboarding. I rail, no one's going to love this, so I'm going to kick off the podcast with making people upset with me, but I have skateboarded for many years, so I consider myself an expert, but I rail against the concept of contests in skateboarding. Like, For me, it is inappropriate to declare a winner of any one event in skateboarding, because it is essentially only a personal battle. You can really only understand skateboarding from the perspective of what can I do? What can I accomplish? How can I engage with this environment? Not against other skateboarders.
Okay. Well, we've annoyed all the skateboarders, but I don't mind.
I think about business the same way. It's like, what can I accomplish? Not what can I do with the resources at hand? Yeah.
Yeah, no, it is. And this is what the pod's about. It's about being the best version of yourself and running at an optimal level. And like I said, there's always going to be someone that's doing something bigger and better. There's always going to be someone that's not keeping up with you. It is just, it is a competition against yourself. I get really annoyed with myself when I know if something goes wrong in recruitment or whatever, if we've done everything this side perfectly, like recruitment 101, stuck to all the fundamentals, but it goes terribly wrong, I'm not happy, but I'm not that frustrated. If we've done something wrong this side that I know we should be better at, that's when I get frustrated. So I do feel you.
Yeah, I am deeply competitive, don't get me wrong, but I find it to be not mentally healthy to compete against someone else all the time as much as to compete against myself. Like, what can I do? Yeah.
Cool. Talking of testing limits, what I'd like to get stuck into, Justin, you've gone from like back in the day, web designer to flicking on to founding multiple companies, CTO, CEO, board member. There'll be a lot of people listening now that hands on keyboard, on the tools, maybe leading a team, maybe at a director level, and having those thoughts about, shall I try this? How shall I move on? How do I get into the entrepreneurial space? Like, how does that transition happen? Where do you start? Yeah, how does that go down, mate?
Yeah, so for me, and I don't know that I recommend this to everyone, I think a combination of hubris and ignorance were part of the initial fire. So my degree is actually in theater, but I programmed for many years when I was a kid. I was always interested in it. But throughout my academic career, I wasn't very attracted to computer science as a field. I wanted to put on plays. Now, when I got out of college and met a girl I liked and wanted to provide for us, and then I knew I needed to make more money. And so I got interested in the tech field. And my first job at British Telecom, people said, man, you're really good at this, Justin. You have a talent for it. Appreciated for the work you do is really attractive. But at British Telecom, it was a very stuffy environment back then. It's not anymore, I'm sure. I'm sure they've let all that go. But they used to issue us socks like with the BT logo on it and stuff. And I was a raver kid of the 90s, right? Like we worked 24/7, 365. I worked the afternoon shift so I could go party all night and see DJs and stuff like that. So it was a lot of fun. But I think that I wanted a new culture. And so my idea about founding companies and operating at an executive level, no one was going to give me that job. No one was going to give me funding. I needed to build it if I was going to get that. And that's how Roundbox started. I had a couple other failed startups, and Roundbox was the first one that really grew. But it was essentially that hubris. I think I can do it better. And I am a little bit ignorant about the right skill set to do it. And wound up school of hard knocks, but building a company. Yeah.
Yeah, no, cool, mate. Yeah. BT had the monopoly for a long time. Yeah, I can imagine what it was like. But yeah, perhaps it's changed. But yeah, have you still got those socks, or have they gone?
No, they're gone. But I still, to this day, remember my old AT Hayes modem commands. And I saw early tech, like now we have the rollover numbers when you log in for multi-factor authentication. And we used to have credit card size calculators that were that number that you had to hang on to watch them. But that was it was powerful, because we were also building a global data network at BT. That's why I was there. That's why that part of the organization existed, is that we were rolling out the internet essentially to the world in frame relay networks. And you don't know it in the moment, but now looking back on it, I realized that I was helping build the internet. And that was very exciting.
Yeah, no, cool. When you say ignorance, do you mean just almost, it'd be nice to hear the ins and outs of what you mean, but essentially just not having the knowledge to perhaps not be scared, not eliminated a lot of fear, and just allowed you to just bang, just go for it?
Yeah, I think for me, almost being unaware of not having that MBA, in a way didn't. Yeah. Having the MBA would have terrified me. I can't do it to that level if I don't have all, if I don't have funding, or if I don't have this skill set, or if I don't have that skill set, I am unable to found a company. But not having that and thinking, especially if I thought about the way we would put on a play, you don't have the expertise to begin. You gain the expertise, but process, you know, through the event of staging the production and finding a team around you that can help you create something. And you need creative space. I think that in any endeavor, business, sports, arts, you need an area where you can start to break some rules or bend them at least to figure out where you fit. Because let's face it, a new startup needs to change the landscape, needs to differentiate itself. It needs to push the old players out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. And Justin, you always pushed off it. You went, yeah, yeah, I had a couple of failed startups. Then I got one that worked. You pushed over it, but I'm sure there was a lot more to it than that. So that didn't set you, that didn't deter you. Was that difficult to get to? Was that quite mentally challenging? What? How did that happen?
They're always disappointing. But they didn't get so far, too far, really. So that might have helped putting them to bed. And one of them, for example, was I wanted to start a record label because I was really into music at the time. We all want to be rock stars when we're 25 and just out of college. And I didn't know the first thing about putting it together. But I did read a bunch of books about starting it, and I started producing music. We started trying to get some distribution going. One lesson out of that was always I read a book about starting, how to start a record label, classic. And the book said, always act like you're bigger than you are. So for example, when I founded Roundbox, my title was not CEO founder. My title was partner, but I was the only employee, you know, for the first 2 years of the business. And so, but I didn't want anyone else to know that. I wanted them to think like I had other partners and, you know, I was not the sole show, but that was it. And I think the other thing that we tried to do was I tried to start a web hosting company, and we found a hard drive supplier, and we were trying to figure out how to build RAID style hard drives to do web hosting. And when I realized how much hard drive space I'd have to buy and code I'd have to write, I was like, yeah, that's not going to work. I'm not going to be able to do it. Yeah. We got the website built though. The website was up. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. It's like that, embrace that. Some people are scared of it. Every entrepreneur you listen to, I don't think I've ever met anyone that's gone, yep, started the first business, absolutely smashed it, never looked back since. No, like typically, I can remember reading a lot of autobiographies at one phase of my life, and most really good business people had literally lost everything like two or three times over. And these are like people that had done really well. So it's just part and parcel of it. If you're pushing the limits, going back to what you said, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a conversation with a colleague in the Northeast, and they were complaining about Silicon Valley invests over and over again in failed founders. And I understand their perspective. It's like you want to invest in people that are successful. But I think I rail against Silicon Valley a lot, and I probably will throughout this podcast. But one thing that they do understand is that most are going to fail. And it's not usually an individual's fault. As a team, you were trying to make the best decisions in the context that you were in. And that's what you want, is you want someone that's willing to learn, make decisions in the context, move the thing forward. Because if you're just hemmed in by fear, then you won't make the progress you need to.
Mm. Yeah, no, definitely. Justin, I'll tell you what, another thing, I'm just going to slightly go off subject here, but...
Please.
In a record label, so there's a podcast in the UK by a guy called Stephen Bartlett called Diary of a CEO, and they had Simon Cowell on about when he started his record label, and it was just fascinating. Like, the amount of times he got punched in the face and got told he was doing this. I'm going to, literally, as soon as we finish this recording, I'm going to ping you on LinkedIn, because you're really... Because I don't mind him. I don't like... dislike him or like him, but after this I was like, oh, I actually really like him. Like, you'll really enjoy it. It's good.
Yeah, that's great. It's a lot of people can make music. It's a terribly competitive field in which to operate, but at the time electronic music was making its big splash from the UK here in the United States, and that was super exciting, and I wanted to share it. Yeah, I was really into house music, so yeah.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I don't mind a bit of house. You've been to Ibiza?
I spent my honeymoon there. It was amazing. Yeah, it was a great party. Me and my wife, it's a fond memory of ours. I saw Sonic at one of the big promoters. It was epic.
Oh yeah, it's great. It's great. Okay, well, I'm talking about all the stuff that I didn't think we'd talk about, but never mind. But I'll try and get back on track. But what I want to talk about is, we've talked about pushing through the failure and having successes. There's a lot of people out there on the job market now that are struggling, and there's some pockets of the market that are still hot, but there's a lot that aren't. And what do you do when you doubt yourself, when you're going through tough times? What have you got any go-to strategies or methodologies that you utilize to keep moving forward, or any like thoughts for people that are getting hit hard on the market right now? Any tips, hints or tips there?
First off, I just want to provide a lot of empathy. It's not easy right now in the tech industry broadly, especially if you're looking for a job. Not a lot of companies are hiring. Not a lot of companies are doing anything to grow their expenses, their expense side. If anything, they're trying to reduce expenses as much as possible. And that's why probably some of our colleagues have experienced layoffs. And that's hard, and it's not easy, and I'm empathetic to those challenges. I have certainly been through it myself. So that being said, I think that you really do need to put one foot in front of the other. And this is probably a lesson learned from the sales side. What I've learned from our go-to-market leaders that I work with, I'm more of a technology product person, but I work with our sales leaders. And what they tell me, and perhaps a good thing here, is if you practice good habits, then you will get to where you want to go inevitably. So if it is, and don't burn yourself out, but it is making one information interview per week. If it is setting a goal for the next quarter to achieve a certain certification or to boost your resume in some way, and you are trying to find the time to put one foot in front of the other and do those good habits, inevitably, you know, the odds are in your favor that something good will take place, whether it's a job that you're looking to get, a role that you want to do, or if you're trying to start a company, the same thing. The things we work at come true, but there's no guide on the amount of time or energy that is.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think everyone's looking for this instant gratification or this silver bullet. Oh, I just did a post before we hit record here about half an hour ago about AI and automation and people using it too much when they're applying for jobs and then wondering why they're getting nowhere. But it's so true. It's almost like focus on the process and almost switch off from the end results. I used to have a thing in recruitment where I'd spend like the first couple of hours a day doing some outreach, the bulk of the middle of the day speaking to candidates, and the last half of the day doing some more outreach. And sometimes you just feel like you were getting nowhere. But if you just switched, I used to say switch off and stick to the routine and be consistent. And then you look up a year later and it's like, oh, actually this is working. But a lot of people can only see here. They can't keep going. It's like, almost falling in love with that process really gets you places, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I get that there are financial concerns, putting food on the table while you're looking for a job or finding that opportunity. And that's just hard to navigate. And lean on your support network, if that's family, if that's a fellow colleague, just stay in touch with where you want to go. Also, there's many times where the first job I took was definitely not the job I wound up doing. I'm a big fan of saying when you start a company, when you found a company, you're generally, you know, when I first started StrikeCraft, we were, you know, I helped with coding. I did a lot of interface design. I leaned on my product jobs to help the company get going, as opposed to hiring people to do all of those jobs. And that, I think, saved money, saved us runway, made me as the CEO and founder, helped me crystallize the vision of the business and where we were going to be valuable and what we're going to do. So get your hands dirty. Have a skill set, right? Like, I do tell this a lot of times to people in breaking into that middle management or first executive roles. I miss the days when I could program. I really do. It would be a lot of fun. I'm sure grass is greener, but it would be a lot of fun to be like, oh, today I'm just going to go solve this problem in our code base. I don't have the chops anymore. Appropriately, my team doesn't let me touch code. It is a lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think as well, regardless of whether you're starting a business or leading a team, when your team see you do that, it's just a different level of respect. And in terms of like retention and keeping and securing the right people, I think that's massive. The amount of phone calls I have with people that are looking for a move passively because the person leading them just doesn't have a clue what they do, or they've got no interest of, like you said, getting their hands dirty. So I think, yes, there's some cost saving there, but I think in terms of like company culture and team morale, I think that's massive.
Yeah. I have this working theory, Thomas, you may disagree, but I'm feeling stronger and stronger about the truth of it. To me, there is really only one signal of good leadership, and that is someone that knows how to set an example. You know, if I have line level contributions that I'm making, if I am willing to jump on a customer success call with a customer that maybe hasn't had the best experience, if I am willing to join a sales call, I might not be able to join all of them, of course, because it's just me and I have a lot of team, but I reinforce that this is the work we do. This is what matters. And so I'm going to write one of those silly books that you buy at the airport that's a business book that says, what is leadership? And it's just going to have one thing in there. Is that a good example?
Just one page. But it's so true, because I just think as well, like you jump on a sales call, like your go-to-market team, your sales team, you know what? Justin didn't have to do that today, but he did, and he showed an interest. And it's absolutely massive. Like I can remember years ago, I used to work in this, when I was a lot younger, I used to work in this bar, and one of the jobs we had to do, like it was this rota, like one of us had to clean the toilets like once a week. And I can remember the owner of the bar came down on my turn, and he did it with me. And it was just like this ultimate respect that I had for him. And it's a bit of a crazy example to give on a security related podcast. It's like going back to getting your hands dirty. It does make a difference. It's good.
Yeah,
it's good. It's good. You said the first job isn't the one you finished on. I think that's a really good point. So when I first started recruiting, I just used to recruit hackers, just pen testers and red teamers. And then eventually I started getting asked for more and more security stuff. So we started just doing anything within the security ecosystem a number of years ago. But the amount of people that wanted to come in at pen tester level or SOC analyst level, and I think that's a really hard route in, because I just think they're such kind of cool jobs to have in security. So I think it's a really good point you make about perhaps don't shoot, you know, maybe come in through the GRC route, or come in as a start on help desk, do some sysadmin work and then come through. I think in terms of breaking in and getting a foothold on the market, I think that's a really smart thing you said there, Justin.
Yeah. Look, you may be aspirational about the job you want to do, but you're generally inside a field and a specific company, you're probably going to start on the first step of the path to that job. And while you may feel that you're ready to do it, it's actually not up to you. There are gatekeepers, there are people that are going to decide. And we do that for a reason, because if we just did whatever we wanted, you know, people, I would put myself in roles that were dangerous. I would have done that. That's why I have investors and board members. We all have bosses. The only thing that changes as you get into a more executive role in your career is you get more bosses. That's the only difference.
Okay.
So I just really believe, like, we had a gentleman on our staff that was really interested in pen testing, but he didn't really have experience. He came from a completely different field than technology altogether, but he had passion and had gotten an initial certification. And we brought him on board as an intern. And within 6 months, he had really picked up a lot of information and he was ready to start being like a penetration testing assistant. We were able to give him a full-time gig. Now he's just an amazing pen tester for the team and he's full on doing the job. His next job, he will not go through that again. He will start as a pen test because he's accomplished pen tester at this point. And then he will start that job and move on. I don't want him to leave, but he does, you know, inevitably that happens. But inevitably he'll move on from that pen tester role to a pen testing manager or working in the operations center or something else that just intrigues him that he wants to go and find. Yeah.
That's it. Do you do that often, by the way? Because so many companies just aren't prepared to do that, bring interns in and get them up to speed. It's wicked that you do. I don't want to get your inbox bombarded on LinkedIn with like intern apps, but is that something that happens, I don't know, annually or just now and again, or do you have a strategy for that? Or
it is my go-to muscle in building teams. Now, I want to say that I would say it's not always successful. So all the things that you would be concerned with are challenges in bringing in young and career people and growing them inside an organization. And I think there are some times where I've overemphasized it when we could have used a much more experienced leader in a certain aspect of the business. So it has some fallibility to it. But there's nothing more energizing than a young and career person at whatever age they come into the business that is really want to learn and be passionate about this, doing that work. And I have created lifelong working relationships with people that started out, for instance, not knowing how to program at all, and now have far surpassed me in their ability around data science or AI or machine learning or large-scale application development. And all I needed to do was give them those first steps to get things rolling. Yeah.
So now that's
what, I do it a fair bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I love that, Justin, because so many employers, they just want this plug and play type scenario, which I get, but they just want to go, and a lot aren't prepared to do that. So it's nice. I can imagine it. I know there's some obvious pitfalls, but I can imagine like people haven't got any bad habits. They pick up like the strike graph methodology. There's no way. Like I can see some real pros with it as well, but it's good.
It's always harder for me to unlearn something than to learn it again. We all go through that experience where you're like, oh, I didn't learn that skill in the right way. Now I've got some bad habits to deprogram. Yeah. The thing, especially if you work in some form of services business, so I'm not sure how many of your listeners might be a consulting type agency or someone that works very closely with their customers. But especially if you're that type of company, I believe your whole business model is literally hiring young and career people that cannot get their first break, but are passionate about it, skilling them up quickly and billing them for more than they cost you until at the point 5 years down the road, they leave that business to go work for someone else. You're literally an education institution. Mm. You need to catch people young, train them more quickly than anybody else can, wrap them in intelligent teammates that can make them successful with your customers, and then know that they're going to leave. You're bringing in the new interns knowing they're going to leave in the future.
Yeah, and getting the almost hiring for aptitude and personality, especially on the consulting side, because, that's the whole game. You're articulating risk to end clients. It's not like a direct sales job, but it is a sales job in a way.
It's a sales job.
Yeah.
Accenture has this wired, right? Because what they do is if you don't go partner track and you leave Accenture, you wind up working at the post office and then you hire Accenture. So it's self-fulfilling in a way, because who trusts Accenture better than the ex-employees that knows how it works? McKinsey works the same way, right? You can always come back to McKinsey if you were an employee. I don't think that's true anymore, but it used to be the thing back in the day. Because the thing is, I was a McKinsey consultant, and then I get hired by Gates Foundation, and then I hire McKinsey to come and do the projects that we wanted to do. Yeah.
Cool. So the intern that you talked about, what did he or she do to grab your attention and get the opportunity? Was there anything unique they did in the application process?
One is that they had accomplished some work on their own. So they had done like A+ certification, which I realize is a very common certification, and it is a generalist type thing, but they obviously wanted to learn so badly that they had learned something on their own. If I were looking for a software developer, the thing I always ask them about is, what open source projects are you contributing to? Because they want to learn so badly, they want to be an engineer so badly that they are spending time donating code. And then the second thing is that I felt like they just had a very congenial nature. They were excited. They exhibited a passion and emotion about what they wanted to do. There was a very pragmatic motivation behind it. It wasn't for kudos. It was, I need to make more money. And the industry the person was working in was required physical labor, and their body was starting to hurt, and they were worried about their future. And so I get that, right? I understand that it's less, if you're a professional athlete, you beat your body up pretty badly, and there's a limit to that career, right? Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Cool. Yeah. So I'm just going to break this down for the listeners, because I think this could be relevant for anyone who's applying for any job, but especially people trying to break in. So really looking for stuff they accomplish on their own in the community, as it were, really want to really demonstrate the fact they want to learn badly. You're going to ask them what open source projects have they contributed to if they're a dev, even if it's SOC analyst or pen testing, and you probably look at how they're contributing to the community or what they've done for essentially for free, genuine passion and excitement, and then finally a real need, want, and desire to come on board and get that break, essentially.
Yeah, on the security side, what I'd say is all of these open source projects need a security reviewer in the process of getting contributions into the code. And if you volunteer to help do those reviews and your name is now attached to that project, that's quite a powerful piece of resume work to walk into a space. And look, on the employer side, they need to be better about skilling people up. To me, it is fundamentally less costly to, if you build a small education program, to get someone into a skill set that you're comfortable with what they're doing, as opposed to relearning everything.
Why not? It's almost odd. I think people have, when I see stuff on LinkedIn, without sounding harsh, when I see stuff on LinkedIn, I've applied for 500 jobs and got nothing back. I'm thinking, were they all personalized? Did you actually look at the role first? Could you tell me the 2-3 key decision makers in each company? Were these really tailored applications that you genuinely wanted, or was it a copy and paste? I'll apply for 100 jobs each week for 5 weeks. I think if you take the time and think about giving something first before getting, and really put yourself out there, if you do it, to your point as well before, if you do it consistently for a sustained period of time, we can't guarantee when, but that break will come.
Probably something that you shouldn't say, Thomas, but I can, is on the hiring manager side. I'll criticize some managers here, and I've made these mistakes as well. You need to fundamentally understand that your vehicle to growth lies in the success of the people you manage. If you are not teaching them and helping them grow, if you simply hired them to fulfill a seat inside your team, you are failing at the job of manager. And it will become a political nightmare. It'll be a war zone. But if you're building them up and making them a part of a very powerful team, and you're the leader of that team, a deep sense of respect for what you can do and opportunities will open up for you later. And look, let's face it, a lot of people get placed in manager roles because they're a pretty good line level contributor, or they had a level of experience, but they don't know how to teach the skills they have learned. And they need to be able to do that.
Yeah, they do. It needs to be a more blended approach, because literally, and like I say, maybe I shouldn't say this, maybe I should, but I'll just say it anyway. But there's so many companies out there, and it's what keeps people, guys like me, in a job, but they just want the ready-made finish, like A+, bang, off you go. Which, again, I think that's fine in balance. I think there should be a blended approach, like some of what you've just described. So they are nurturing talent coming through and building and managing and developing, and that creates loyalty and stuff like that. And I think there's got to be an element of that, not just all bring me the finished article, get them from somewhere else, bring them across from here. Here's the companies that we know they're great. Go and get them for. There's a place for that, but it's got to be combined with what you've said, because otherwise it's not helping the industry as a whole either.
Yeah. 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 Kids these days, my younger niece and nephew, they will learn something on YouTube in a heartbeat. They'll be like, oh, I am now interested in this subject. And I do it too. This past year, I've become really fascinated with geology. And I find myself spending a lot of time watching geologists talk about geology lately. And I feel like I've learned a fair bit. I bore my wife to tears now when we're going through a drive. I'm like, oh, do you know how that rock formed, this rock formed that way?
I think we take it for granted. Like I did a post about this, Ed, because I was talking about, like, years ago, like, education was saved for the most wealthy and privileged people in society. And when you think about what we have access to, if I'm talking recruitment, I've got about 4 or 5 podcasts I go on, and I can listen to literally the best recruiters in the world across multiple different industries, and I can listen to a podcast every week from someone that's, like, currently the best in the world. It's like, how good is that? And I've just paid for this training course, which is, you have to pay for access each month, and it's great, and it's like, I can just do all that in this room. And it's like, I think sometimes we're talking about it now, so we're probably not taking it for granted, but sometimes it's like, when you actually just stop and think, that is amazing. Like, we should all be using it. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
So So yeah, cool. So your wife's getting annoyed with the geology. She's getting a bit frustrated.
Yeah, we have a wild set of. I was just this last weekend in a place that was at one point a major basalt lava floodplain. Essentially, you can see hundreds of feet that were a molten lake of lava at some point in this canyon. And then it ended, and now we have this huge, then we had glaciers that cut all this rock out. You just think about the story of the thing, and you just can't help but imagine it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's that curious mindset, which I think is intrinsically linked to career growth and career development, especially in security, definitely. But I think it's really interesting, Justin, that you started off in theatre, and then you've perhaps done stuff maybe the opposite way around. And I think that's probably linked heavily to your success, because I think we've talked a lot about consulting, and that leads on to communication. And if you've come from the theatre arena, like, your communication's naturally going to be really good. How much of a part has that played in your progression, and for people listening that want to enhance those communication skills that know they're not sharp enough, how can they do it?
Yeah. So certainly, especially in my role as a CEO and a founder, one of the things I do all the time is I do a lot of storytelling. And most liberal arts degrees, to some amount, involve storytelling. Now, in theater, that's the fundamental thing we're doing, or like a film school situation. You are concocting a story to tell, understanding why that story has meaning, staging it so the meaning is revealed to your audience, and then also learning how the audience perceived that story and how you met your intentions, essentially. But even you could be a history degree and you're writing a lot of compare and contrast papers, or you're writing a descriptive about a certain time in history, and you are concocting a story, or utilizing the right set of correlated facts to build an overview of what's going on. None of this is different than trying to design a technical architecture. If you'll permit me, I'll use StrikeGraph here. There's some fundamental stories we wanted to tell in our solution. One of those stories is we want to design a singular security posture. This is the security we're going to operate. And we want to be able to measure that security posture against any standard immediately to know, are we SOC 2 compliant? Are we HIPAA compliant? Are we ISO 27001 compliant? I just told you a story, Thomas. I had a beginning to that story, what I wanted. I had a middle, and I had, you know, what the value was at the end. And that was something we did almost 5 years ago in founding the company. What was the story I wanted to tell? And I tell that story on every single sales call. And I'm constantly tweaking and perfecting it. So I think if you manage people, if you want to push even, let's say you're a senior engineer and you want to push technology forward, being able to communicate why that's valuable to a broader audience is critical to success.
Yeah, devil. Like I say, you can relate it to everything. You just related it there to being a business owner. If you're piecing together a pen testing report, you need to do that well and tell a great story to get those findings fixed and get that budget signed off. If you're leading your team and developing your team and you're wanting to get more productivity out of them because they're all working remotely and they're scattered all over the world or the US, whatever it might be. Again, it's storytelling's a major, and also it doesn't feel like you're being sold to. It's a really nice way of doing it.
Yes. If the story rings true, it's more about us interacting as humans that have a shared interest in a space. And we can use these stories and push them into metaphors or other things that we're like, well, that resonates. I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it definitely does. Cool. All right, Justin. So in terms of, I normally say this once a little bit later, but I'll ask you now, any kind of books, or I used to say a book or podcast or content you're consuming online that's really helped your career progression over the years? Doesn't have to be security related. It can be, could be self-help, self-development, anything that's really helped you grow over the years?
I'm not very good at reading self-help books, especially in business. I'm really bad about it, actually. But there are some critical books along the way, or media that I consumed. I definitely think that there are old programming manuals that I still have, like my old Apple Basic book, my old Java book, project, some of the more technical things. Recently, from a career perspective, one of the books that have been really helpful for me is the textbooks for certified public accountants, like audit and audit services, because we deal a lot with the technicalities of audit and audit services. And I wanted to know deeply how it worked. I read a lot of scientific papers. I recently read a scientific paper about security in the Chrome Web Store. I read scientific papers on the physics and computer science side, especially as we're dealing with quantum stuff. So I do consume a lot. However, I think it's important, and I was considering it actually this weekend, intriguingly enough, to cross-pollinate your knowledge. I mentioned I've been reading a lot about geology lately, and one of the things that was interesting to me was I was looking at some geological maps and the way tectonic plates worked, and it reminded me of a technology architecture that I had been considering, and the interconnectedness of certain pieces of data, as well as the interconnectedness of certain rock formations over time. And so bringing that metaphor over was really powerful. So I tend to spread my wings a little bit. You asked me some of my favorites, Thomas. I highly recommend people read Three Body Problem if you haven't. It is science fiction, but it is an epic story. Terrifying, really fun. And then the podcaster that I listen to the most right now is a gentleman by the name of Nick Zintner. And he is a geologist with, I think it's Central Washington University, but he's an amazing storyteller and just credible lecturer. And so I'm definitely attracted to the medium and the material.
Yeah, cool. No, thanks, man. And it's like for everyone listening, like, I mentioned earlier that you've clearly like a curious guy, like you don't leave any, like you're reading about, you talked about Chrome security. Post something about that. Or did I see something?
Yeah.
I
have a similar podcast as what you're doing, but for security, Secure Talk, and Cheryl Hsu, one of the researchers on that, came and talked to us. You know, the form of learning where we listen to a dialogue has been lost, I think, in our factory education system a lot of times. And podcasts are bringing it back. I think that's why people are so interested in them, is because didactics, you know, the old Greek form of, we're going to have a debate, you're going to listen to the debate, and you're going to learn from the debate your perspective, as opposed to treating political debates like a gotcha moment. You know, it's so ridiculous. But when we have an opportunity to listen to people dialogue as opposed to lecture, there's a new opportunity for humans to unlock information. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I interviewed Cheryl, she's a great researcher, and we dug it. I mean, it was crazy, the numbers. There were, I think, hundreds of millions of people that have been affected by nefarious plugins in the Chrome Web Store.
Yeah. My next question, by the way, was literally going to be, tell us about what people can learn from your pod, but you've told us some, but tell us more.
I jumped in. Yeah, the broadest definition of security possible. We do jump around a fair bit. I like interviewing authors, so we have a fair number of authors, but they can be very different types of authors. For instance, I'm releasing an episode where we interviewed the authors of this book, Job Security. And these are two humanities professors. One is a written author and the other is a visual artist. And they both had fathers that worked in the security field. And there was a secrecy when we work in security. Mm-hmm. And they were interested in developing profiles of other security workers. Actually, for those people that listen to your podcast that are interested in breaking into the security field, I highly recommend it because it's massive, right? There's a lot of entry points into security. It's not just penetration testing. And if you want to read about people's stories, that I thought is really interesting. Of course, this is not like a highly technical cybersecurity issue. This is more about the sociological research around security. But absolutely intriguing work represented. And so it goes from things like Chrome Web Store cyber attacks into more of the story of security and people that work in security to, we did one on the history of the Tor browser, which is absolutely intriguing. Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
That is, yeah.
Yeah. That's been a lot of fun, but it always has some form of security theme, but it is not always very pigeonholed. Like we only talk to cybersecurity workers. Yeah. We're going to have, I think I'm very excited about an episode. It's probably going to come out in October where we discuss election security with someone that, because our elections are coming up here in the United States, if no one knew, right? But we met with a gentleman, Mark Listies, who's the CEO of Pendulum, he actually worked for the U.S. Elections Commission for a while. And so we dive into election security as a topic. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I always say I'll never talk about politics at work, but then like whenever someone mentions the US, because I'm glued to it, by the way. We won't dive into it too much, but like it is, it's fascinating. I'm interested in, obviously, we do a lot of business in the US. Matt, it's fascinating to see what's going on, but it's, I think this time will be looked back in history as like the most eventful, crazy time ever. It's, there's a lot going on, isn't there?
It's pretty wild. I won't, we don't have to discuss candidates so much. If anyone sees a picture of me, I fit the mold of who you think I would vote for. So it's not that big a deal. But what I will say that's absolutely intriguing is if I wanted to push democracy as a practice forward, I think there are some things that I think we should bring to the United States. One is I'm a big fan of stack rank voting. I know they do it in Ireland, and I think they wind up with a better representation of the middle of the road of where people are at. And so I know Maine has implemented it broadly here in the United States. And so we could see some of that work, but the United States is a massive country, Thomas. We are heterogeneity. Like Arkansas is very different than Missouri and they're right next to each other. I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, but rural Georgia, where I spent much of my time, is very different. Makes the country both exciting and interesting and vibrant, but also can create a lot of tension. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I can. I mean, yeah, I don't think people outside the US have any comprehension. You can fit the UK inside Texas five times. Like, it's just huge. And by the way, I can really notice it. Like, when I'm talking to a client on the West Coast, it's very different to talking to a client who lives in the middle of New York, like vastly different. Like I can really feel it. Like it's, again, it's fascinating. It's what makes it such an interesting country. But yeah, we'll get your podcast in the show notes. We'll get Three Body Problems and Nick Zentier. We'll get everything in the show notes and we'll get that one about election security in there as well. And yeah, it'll be good. But yeah, to your point as well about podcasts coming back, and I don't know if it's like your listening skills have got better since you started your pod. Yeah, like I have as well. It really enhances your active listening skills, I think.
Also, my poor team, I listen to someone else's. And I'm competitive too. And I'm like, oh, did you hear how they did that? And the production quality there? And how do we bring that to what we're doing? They're like, Justin, we're just trying to get a thing out a week, man. So.
Yeah, we did it. Well, we ended up getting a couple of people on the team, like, because it was like, by the time you're chasing up guests, then it's like, oh, can we do some sound bites? Oh, and before you know it, you've literally got one or two people on it, and they've spent most of their week just working on the podcast, and they've done no other work. But you can't help it. It's good. It's good fun.
It's been fun, and we're up to about 4,000 listens a month, which has been great to see the activity and the growth. Of course, we all start from somewhere and end up somewhere else. But as long as we're moving in the right direction, I'm almost always very happy and pleased. Yeah,
definitely. But it goes back to what you said at the start. It's about consistency and just refining it and improving it a little bit each week. And then you look around 2, 3, 4 years down the line and it's flying. So it's good. But yeah, mate, I've enjoyed this. We've got up to about an hour really quickly. It's been nice to sit down. I know we've been planning this for a while, so it's nice to finally pin you down, my friend.
Too hard for you.
It's been nice, and it's good to have a chat. And I know you're a busy chap, so I do appreciate it. And yeah, thanks for your time again, my friend. And I hope we didn't get in the way of the maintenance men too much with this recording. I hope we've managed that. You've got your building work done okay.
It's a real pleasure to chat, Thomas, and I love the topics, and no, it's no trouble at all, as we would say in the UK maybe. And look forward to staying in touch.
Yeah, definitely. I'll see you soon. Thanks, buddy.